Okay, thank you. Yeah, well, it's a pleasure to be here. Let me start with that. I was planning to talk about scattering amplitudes at strong coupling, but I decided to change my topic because I realized there already have been some talks on some of the issues I was going to talk about, and I don't want to repeat what other people have said. Well, wait until I give the first. I've decided to talk about a slightly different topic, which is a paper we wrote with Diego Hoffman, which is, we call conformal collider physics. This is not a topic yet related to integrability, but the objective here is to describe certain observables in conformal field theories that are closely related to the observables we measure in a collider experiment. So in conformal field theories, we are used to computing quantities such as correlation functions of operators, for example, Wilson loops and so on. One wonders about, one can ask whether one can compute things like scattering amplitudes or other processes that are closely related to the things we measure in theories like QCD or the experiments we do in colliders. And the objective here is to talk about observables which are well defined, so they are finite, and so on. So as opposed to scattering amplitudes, which need an infrared regulator. By doing this, one can, in the case that we have a conformal field theory, one can say some fairly general things about these observables, and one can say them in a very simple way. And one can derive them in a very simple way. And I'll also discuss some more theoretical applications of thinking about these observables. So thinking about these observables, you can impose some bounds on certain quantities that appear in the field theory, which I know how to derive only by using these observables and not the ordinary correlation functions of operators and the Euclidean theory. Okay, so the basic idea is that we have something similar to a collider experiment, let's say, where we, let's say, have some well-defined initial state that produces some state in our conformal field theory. So just to clarify ideas, imagine a situation where we have an E plus E minus collision that creates a gamma or a C boson, and then this gamma or C bosons decays into some object in QCD, for example. Then if we treat the electron and the photon or the C as a known physics, and let's say the QCD as the field theory we're interested in studying, what this does is this photon creates some state in the QCD theory that we then wish to study. So the state is created by an operator, so the electromagnetic current. So for example, in the case of the photon, would be the electromagnetic current in QCD. With some form momentum, which is given by the form momentum of this photon, and this acts on the vacuum, and this creates some state in QCD that then we like to study its properties. So this type of states in the conformal field theory are states created by a local operator that create a bunch of particles that then expand to infinity, and we wish to study the properties of those particles that go to infinity. So this is a slightly simpler problem than a problem where we have particles coming from infinity and then going to infinity. The initial state is clearly defined, and then we are just only asking properties about the final state. Now, of course, we can ask questions such as, what's the probability that this photon or this operator creates a state that has n gluons, n gluon final states. And we can calculate this in, let's say, a tree level. We can calculate it in perturbation theory. And tree level will get something finite, but once we start considering loop corrections, we'll get infinities. And so those infinities are these infrared divergences I mentioned before. So that's not a good question, even though one can regulate it and consider the regulated form of these expressions, and certainly you can study those things mathematically, but the things you're going to measure physically are not such things. So the infrared finite question is to ask what's the probability that, for example, the photon goes to n jets. Now, this is a probability that will be finite, but its precise value will depend on how you define these jets. So what exactly you mean by a jet. And so typically, I guess you probably all know this, but I'm just going to repeat it. So a jet is saying that you have, let's say you have a jet at this point, if you have some energy concentrated within some angle delta in this point, in this region, and you have less than a certain low energy cutoff outside that region. Okay, so for example, a state with two jets, you allow any energy within two small angles delta, and energy less than this here. So here there could be any amount of energy, and so on. So, and then these amplitudes will depend on what these cutoff energies are here outside, and what the cutoffs are on delta. And the infrared divergences that we had in the original calculation translate into some dependence on the amplitude on delta and this epsilon. Okay. Now, so this is something practical that one could try to calculate, and people calculate, and there is, of course, a lot of effort going into calculating such things. There is another infrared finite observable that one can define that, in principle, is equivalent to this one. But it's a little simpler to think about theoretically, which are the energy correlations. So here, instead of computing probabilities, one computes correlation functions. So the idea is that you have, so here what I'm plotting now is some angle theta, and on the vertical axis I'm going to plot the energy deposited per unit angle on some calorimeters that are placed around the region where we had the collision. And so if you have, let's say, one instance of the experiment, there is one collision, so after the collision your calorimeters will detect some energy distribution. Let's say after one instance it could look like that. The next time you do the experiment, there could be an extra peak here. This will move, and so on. So that's how each instance of the experiment would look like. So you have a random energy distribution with some probability that tells you. So there is some probability that you measure a particular distribution of energies, right? And in principle, all we are talking about is computing this probability. So when we compute jet amplitudes, we are computing specifying certain classes of functions and computing certain probabilities. And we could also equivalently consider expectation values of the energy. So we pick certain points here, and we compute the we take the products of the energies and compute the expectation values on this state. And that's equivalent to computing this. So if you know all these expectation values, in principle, you can deduce this probability and calculate jet amplitude. So in principle, they are equivalent. But in practice, if you only know, let's say, one or two energy correlation functions, they are different observables. Now, these are observables that people certainly introduced in the 70s, when also these were introduced by Weinberg and Sternman. And this one's here by Ellis, Loeb, and Basham, and forgetting one person. But so you can consider them, and you can measure them, and people measure them in experiments. And certainly, for example, is measuring energy correlation functions at LEP, the two-point function, is a way to calculate alpha strong. So, anyway, so that now we're going to be talking about such energy correlation functions. Notice a couple of remarks of how these observables are defined. So you choose the angles a priori. You don't say, "Oh, I had some energy here. I'm going to compute. I'm going to select this angle." You select these angles a priori, and then the energy might happen to go in that event to that angle, or might not go to that angle, and might have a lower value of the energy. And if there is no energy in that event, in that angle, that contributes zero to the sum, and so on. So we're going to sum over all events of whatever the detector measures at that particular angle. So that's just the definition of the observable, just to make clear. What? Yeah, this is the energy per unit angle. So we're imagining a detector with infinite resolution, so we could talk about the energy per unit angle. That's just theoretically. In practice, you might imagine that you can integrate over a small angle. And yeah.
Isn't it better just to take the Fourier transform of that and going to harmonics?
You can also do that. Yeah, that's right. So that. You can do many things. So this is definitely. There is a problem which is formally similar, which is the problem of computing the temperature fluctuations on the sky, which is which is also determined by a random distribution, and we have energy coming from different portions of the sky, and we like to so in that case we compute exactly this. So how much temperature we have at each region in the sky, and we compute correlation functions. And so in that case, it's useful to go to spherical harmonics if you know that the initial distribution was spherical. So that might or might not be useful. What was I going to say? Yeah, so that those. For distributions that are very close to spherical, this is definitely the best way to think about it in terms of energy correlation functions. For distributions that are very random, like the usual results of collisions at weak coupling, then it might be more useful to think about this sort of a different basis where that is closely related to the statistics of this energy distribution. So here the statistics is that you produce narrow jets and so on, and that's what people do when they compute these jet amplitudes. So that's roughly. Okay, so and these energy correlation functions defined this way translate into an essentially ordinary quantum mechanical, an ordinary expectation values, like the ordinary expectation values we compute in, So this quantity is just simply, you take the vacuum of the theory, you act with the operator we were discussing there. So for example, J of Q, so that we act with that operator. And then we compute certain operators I'm going to define in a second. And then the dagger of this operator. So that would give us these energy correlation functions. And we might or might not wish to divide here by the same thing without any insertions. That would be just the total rate. So these operators are simply given in terms of the stress tensor. So this is the total energy flux per unit angle. So the energy flux is just dCOI eta I integral dt. So our physical detector was there during the whole duration of the experiment. So it's integrating the energy as a function of time. It's not computing exactly at what time the energy comes out. So that's information we don't care about. So we have this thing. And our detectors are placed at some very large position r. And so we place them at some large position r. We compute this at some large position r. And then we compute per unit angle. So that's this factor of r squared. And then we take the limit when r goes to infinity. And that's in principle, that is the definition of this operator. So it's essentially a limit of correlation functions of the stress tensor. So you have the current, the insertions of the stress tensor, and you take a specific limit.
Detectors can only measure energy, nothing else.
Well, you could imagine detectors that measure other things, and so you could have detectors that measure charge. So it's slightly simpler to consider about the detectors that measure these conserved quantities, or you can also measure other things. I'm going to mainly talk about this, the energy ones, but and we'll see that we'll see in a second that even in the context of measuring these energies, we are led naturally to consider other operators. Okay, so now this, so this is some operator defined on a two-sphere, and there is the ordinary Lorentz symmetry of the theory acts on this two-sphere, and it acts on the two-sphere as the conformal group on the two-sphere. So there is an SL2C, so SL2C is just SO13. Just this is the ordinary group of Lorentz transformations, and it acts on the two-sphere. So this is an operator that will have some conformal transformation properties under this conformal group of the two-sphere, and it acts, it transforms as a dimension 3 operator. So that, this is just following how this transform under boosts, and that's a simple story. Now, when you consider such objects, this look a little similar to correlation functions in a conformal field theory, but they are not correlation functions in an SL2C invariant ground state, but they are correlation functions in a state which is not SL2C invariant because you haven't inserted this quantity. So this thing here, even though these operators have definite properties under conformal transformations, the whole object does depend. It's not because this vacuum has some information about the momentum of the particle. Okay. Now, okay, one can, so now what I like to do is to relate this problem, rephrase this problem just slightly by bringing this surface, which is at infinity, to a finite location. And that will help us think a little more clearly about these operators, because here it looks well, it's some funny limit. Why should this limit exist? It's not clear what properties they will have, and so on. So things will become a little clearer if we do a simple conformal transformation that maps the boundary of Minkowski space to some finite location inside our space. So in other words,
so far are you assuming the conformal symmetry?
No, so what I've said up to now, I'm not assuming conformal symmetry. I will now assume it to map it to slightly simpler, well, to take a different point of view.
So what kind of problem might exist in the R going to infinity? Like, transformation should be very smooth.
Well, if you think there is no problem, then...
So what kind of problem do you see?
You see, people would tell you that if the theory is not free in the infrared, you can't define these things, for example. So can these things be defined even in cases like in conformal field theories where interactions continue and particles continue to fry, to split and so on, over and over and so on?
So one theory does not act on time. Just you fix the time instance.
So here I'm integrating over time. Is this it? Yeah. I mean, this operator could be inserted at some definite time, or here I thought of it as...
What is precisely this SL2C?
It's just the Lorentz transformations and rotations. So this is the Lorentz group. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so, I mean, this is all up to here, is all simple kinematics. And what I'm going to describe here is also simple kinematics, but I'm going to use conformal transformations. So. We have the original Poincaré patch where we create something here and the particles propagate outwards, and we have our detectors at some finite R position. So here I'm representing a Penrose diagram where this is time and this is the radial direction. And so a line of fixed radial position is here, and things cross these lines. And we are integrating the stress tensor along this line. And in the R going to infinity limit, we are really integrating along this line. So we're really integrating the stress tensor along an L line. And to make this more explicit, one can do a conformal transformation where this whole null plane is mapped to the plane that just goes through the origin of Minkowski space. So these are the, let's say we have the Minkowski space here labeled by coordinates x mu. We go to some coordinates y mu where the infinity is mapped to y plus equal to 0. So we choose light cone coordinates. And so y plus equal to 0 will be that infinity. And well, this I guess you're used to this type of conformal transformation. It's just an ordinary element of the conformal group. Okay, so and then once you do that, then the operator we are integrating along this line is just simply dy minus d minus minus of y. Okay, so we can think of this as some e, which is a function of some transverse position y. So this sits at y plus equal to 0, and it depends on y minus y transverse, and of course, as I said, y plus is equal to 0. So this is something that depends on two coordinates, and these two coordinates are the two transverse coordinates to the Lycon, so the whole set of coordinates are y plus, y minus, and two transverse coordinates, so y1 and y2. And these two coordinates are just simply parameterizing the two sphere. So this is just the map that takes you from here to there is just the ordinary Riemann projection of the plane to the sphere. So that's just simple kinematics.
Are you assuming that you're dealing exclusively with massless fields?
Yes. At this point, in order to say that, computing this in the original theory is the same as computing a similar thing now. So we have the conformal map of the external operators, and now this E of Y's, right? There I have assumed that we have a conformal field theory, right? If we didn't have a conformal field theory, we could do this transformation, but then on this plane we have a theory whose coupling depends on Y plus. So because the coupling will be dimensionful, and then the theory with constant coupling in these coordinates transforms into a theory with a coupling that varies as you go to y plus quantum infinity. So, for example, simple situation. Well, I'm not sure if I want. But let's consider the conformal case for the moment. And anything that I'm saying here could be extended to any number of dimensions. And I mean, these details would be changed, whether I have a two-sphere, a three-sphere, a circle. That would change.
You have some feeling that this still is going to tell you something about QCD.
Yes. So, for this to tell me something about QCD, we'll need to then consider the case where the coupling will change and take that into account. That hasn't been done explicitly, but that.
This is
already finite, and there is no limit involved. So before we had to take some limit. Here we just simply take the stress tensor and integrate it along a lilac direction.
But isn't that R infinity assumed? I thought you were doing this at future null infinity.
Yeah. So this is at future null infinity in the ordinary Poincaré coordinates. But by a conformal transformation, I can map it to the.
Right. So implicitly, that limit's there.
Oh yeah, sure. I mean, after you, this thing with the limit included translates into this operator. Yeah. So factors of R come in the conformal rescaling, the change of coordinates, and so on, and you get something finite in the end. Okay. Okay, so far this is just a definition of these observables, and the only point so far is that indeed these observables can be defined in a conformal field theory and are given by finite expressions, and it's more clear that they are well defined if you think about it from this point of view, but these are clearly well defined observables that are of infrared finite and that we could compute in a conformal field theory. So if you're interested in studying conformal field theories from an abstract point of view, these are good observables to try to consider and to try to calculate. And okay, so now I'm going to discuss one property of these observables that can be derived in a simple way that encodes a little bit some information about how energy is distributed in these events. So we are used to the fact that if we have
in the expression you had originally,
yeah,
you didn't worry about time ordering.
Oh yes, I forgot to say that. So here the operators are ordered in this particular order. So what we're computing is an expectation value, not a time ordered correlation function. So here we first have this operator, then we have all these other operators, and then we have this one. Now, you might worry that there is some time ordering of these guys.
Well,
these guys come suddenly are inserted at earlier time than these ones.
But the energy
and then
off.
Yeah, and then the energy is this integral, so you might worry that there is some time ordering issue there. Now, in this representation, you see that the line, the two of these guys are going to be separated in the transverse plane, and so they are going to be separated by a space-like distance. So we have two things, and for any two times, two values of y minus. So let's say we're integrating two insertions of a stress term. So this is y minus one, y minus two. Unfortunately, the blackboard is not three-dimensional, but this is not y plus, though.
But that is special to Maslow's. If you have massive particles.
Well, the point is essentially that it is true that here we'll have to choose some ordering, but the idea is that after you take this limit, this ordering, so any commutators or any particles that propagate between these two insertions are going to be highly suppressed because they are very far apart in space. Let me say it in this language also. So here, you have these two things that are always space-like separated. So certainly this limit is clear. Well, there are no issues. However, if you make these things slightly time-like and then you took the limit, then certainly if you go far enough apart, you'll have zero distance. But those things, when you take limit, are pushed infinitely far away. So from this point of view, all these operators are operators that commute with each other. And this is indeed what you expect physically, because when we measure some energy at some point here, we don't worry that this energy at this point and energy at this point are non-commuting operators. So those are commuting operators. I mean, we implicitly, well, of course, we assume that when we do the experiment. Okay. Now, so what I'm going to discuss now is the fact that you can do an operator product expansion in when you take two of these positions and you take them close to each other. So that's the same as saying we are looking at energies which are, we look at two positions close to each other, and we are trying to study what those energy correlation functions are for small angles. Physically, this will be capturing the so if you have your sphere or whatever, and you are looking at two angles that are close to each other, you are capturing the physics of collinear singularities, so the splitting of gluons and so on. And so you expect to recover the things that that usually people say about those processes, and we'll see how they show up here, and we'll see. Well, and you can derive all those results in a simple way, as I'm going to.
What are the conformal properties of epsilon? How does it transform under conformal transformations?
Under these conformal transformations, under Lorentz transformations, it has a conformal weight 3, and so it transforms as a primary of conformal weight 3. That's this E, so the integrated thing. And there is another another important transformation, which is the dilatation. So the original dilatation in the original coordinates. Yeah, let me mention this. So here we have Lorentz, right? Lorentz transformations and dilatations, right? Plus some others, but so the others will change the surface, so we don't care too much about those. And then those transform in this language to these conformal transformations SL2C, right?
You define it as something preserving the line. Preserving the light line.
Well, it, here we are interested in preserving the whole surface here. So these are just the transformations. We exclude the special conformal transformations. And then we have the dilatations, which in this language are a boost in the plus minus coordinates. So in y plus y minus. It's also useful to focus here on some generator here, which is the boost in x plus x minus. And this translates into the dilatation of the y coordinates. Okay, so this dilatation is just saying that, well, if you increase all the energies, right, so you increase the energy of this insertion, then this correlation function should increase like the power of energy, which is given by the number of insertions you have here. So each operator has dimension one under this dilatation operation. And in this language is the statement that the number of minus indices of this operator is one, and so it's an operator of spin one. So, okay. So these are going to be two symmetries that we're going to use. So the boosts in y plus and y minus, and the dilatations in y plus and y minus, which corresponds to the original boost and the original dilatations. Okay. So now we want to do an operator product expansion. So we take this at some position y, and let's say some other at position, let's say y equal to 0, and we want to expand it in powers of y. And the statement is that this will have some expansion. If you forget the fact that these are some slightly weird operators, you say you have two operators, well, you'll have some expansion in terms of the dimensions of operators. So we have times some other operators, O n. So this is the typical structure of operator product expansions. And so what I need to explain is what kind of operators we have here and what their dimensions are and why do we expect to have such an expansion. Okay, now in order to do that we need to understand a little better what we are doing. So we are taking two of these operators, which are integrals over y minus, and taking them close to each other. But I mentioned already that the distance between these two points is always y transverse squared, and in particular it's independent of the position y minus. So we can have contributions to this operator product expansion from points that are far, far away. Okay, so when we take the limit, we'll get something which is defined again on the line, but might end up being a bilocal operator. So it might be that what we have is we have the two, so let's, we have two insertions of the stress tensor, each of which is has two fields, let's say, and we contract one of the fields, and then the other fields are left uncontracted, and we are left with an operator with two fields at different positions. And they all contribute equally. You can't assume that they are close to each other. Okay, so the operator that appears here then will be such a bilocal operator. That's a lowest order in the coupling. At higher orders in the coupling, there could be more fields and more insertions of the operator. But in general, we'll have such bilocal operators. And in addition, there is the integral over the center of mass. So the way I'm going to write this operator is as the integral dy minus as O some operator On, and with three minus indices, that is characterizing the spin, again at y plus equal to 0 and y transverse equal to 0. Now, okay, so why am I putting these three minus indices? Here, the left-hand side transforms in a simple way under boosting the y plus y minus directions. Notice that the operators are inserted at y plus equal to 0, so a boost leaves that insertion point the same, and a boost will change y minus, but we are integrating along y minus, and these have definite spin under those boosts. So the left-hand side has total spin 2, so the right-hand side has to have total spin 2, so this operator has 3 minus indices, and with this integral, it has spin 2. So that's where the spin, so the spin on the right-hand side has to be the same as on the left-hand side, and that's all we are saying here. Okay, so that was the spin. And then what about this power here? So the power that appears here is related to something which is called the twist of the operator. So if we think about the dilatation, so this dilatation we were talking about here, minus this boost, or let's call it S. So this is an operation which is defined in such a way that y minus doesn't transform. So so this doesn't count. So delta minus S it will be 2 for this operator, and so it's 2 for the left-hand side. So that's where this factor of 4 comes from, and Tn is the whatever twist this operator will have. Okay. And that's something we can calculate and could depend on the coupling, on the coupling constant. Okay, so to lowest order in the coupling, these operators are just simply bilocal operators. So the insertion of some field at some point y minus, and then some other field at some point y minus prime, and we integrate over the distance between y minus and y minus prime. So this is the structure of O, with some particular weights, y minus y minus prime, to some particular weight, which depends on the spin. Okay? Okay. Yeah, so that's right. To define it a little better, you need to put some Wilson line here. So at lowest order, you can write the operators in this way. These operators are the operators which have twist 2 at when lambda is 0, or when the coupling alpha is 0. And then as the coupling increases, the twist will start being a little bigger. So there are some operators where this is 2, and then when the coupling increases, they will have some constant times lambda and so on. So here notice that the power here, the final power that we'll get here, will go like 1 over y square minus some, this coefficient will be positive, so minus something positive, lambda times something positive. So this 1 over y squared, so let's forget this, that leads to I was planning to say that later. So let's remember this for a second. And let's just say a few words about these non-local operators that appear here. So they can be classified by the symmetries of this problem, and if you consider these ones that are made of just two field insertions, then conformal symmetry is enough to essentially classify them. So what happens is that for each spin, each spin will give you a particular weight function that you put here, and that determines the operator and will determine the conformal weight as a function of the spin. So this delta minus S will be known as a function of the spin S of the operator. And you can define these operators for even real spin. The spin, I should emphasize, that does not have to be an integer. In fact, in this particular case, we get this spin 3, And there's actually no local operator that has spin 3, but there are such non-local operators with spin 3. So you need to really consider spins that are not the spins that are allowed for local operators, but a little more general spins. Okay. Now, of course, this is not the the first place where these operators appear. I mean, these operators appear always, and they are always appearing for the same reasons. So the it's because we have a fast-moving particle, and so in many circumstances we really should be thinking not in terms of we are exchanging local operator, but we are having correlation functions of such operators. And of course, the most the simplest case and most studied case is the case of deep inelastic scattering. And indeed, parton distribution functions are simply matrix elements of such operators, except that they are matrix elements of these non-local operators, maybe I shouldn't digress too much, but they are not with definite spin. They are some superposition of different spins. I mean, what you really fix is the relative momentum between this insertion and that insertion. And if you wanted the operator with definite spin, you have to take moments of the PDF. So that's this is, of course, understood story. And in fact, these operators are sometimes used for doing these calculations. And so here we shall see them appearing in these observables, which are the scattering amplitudes. And you think that this is something that is happening at infinity, but really through this transformation, it's happening at some finite position, and you get the same structure. And in fact, you get something even simpler than what you normally get, because when you do deep inelastic scattering, you naturally get a superposition of all these operators. Here you get operators with a definite spin. So the scaling properties are much simpler. We got this very simple behavior under for the OPE, which is much simpler than the Altarelli-Parisi equation you get for deep inelastic scattering. Now, here of course, in general, you'll have several operators that could appear. At twist 2 in certain theories, the number of operators will depend on the theory you have. And for example, for QCD, you have two operators with the right quantum numbers. For n equal to 4 superior mils, you have three operators, one made out of the gluon, one made out of the fermions, and one made out of the scalars. You have those three operators. And these anomalous dimensions have been computed, so at week up to two loops by Kotigov and Lipatov. And so you can just read off their calculations. And in principle, one might imagine that once one understands how to do spin chains for finite number of sites, one will be able to compute these dimensions for all values of the spin. Okay, so now let me make a remark about this particular weight that appears here. Of course, once we translate that to the angle, this just translates into something like 1 over theta squared. Let me set lambda to 0 for a second. And then if you integrate over the angle, you'll get an infinity. And this is the usual infinity that appears in at tree level when you take this collinear emission. If you take this tree-level diagram and you integrate over all the phase space here, you get that divergence, which in the usual way people say it is that then these divergence will be canceled against the one-loop correction for this type of diagram. Now here, when you go to finite lambda, so you are resumming all those corrections, and you get this minus some constant times lambda. So you can write this times some constant times lambda, and now this will be finite. And so even after you integrate, we get finite answers. And you could imagine integrating this, and so this correction will be of order lambda for weak coupling, and you can get a simple formula for how the angle scales as a function of the coupling. So this gives you some information about the angle of the jet, because you can integrate this, and you get this diagram is for the lambda, even the original one, and by doing this integral, you get 1 over c times lambda times, we do the integral between 0 and theta, some angle theta 0, and so we get this theta 0 to the gamma times, this constant times lambda. So here what we are doing is we are taking some position and we are integrating the second insertion around some region. So if we have a concentrated jet, most of the energy will be contained here. And if we demand that a certain fraction of the energy is contained here, so then theta zero will be some fraction, so some number less than one. And by simply inverting this relationship, you get that this theta zero is equal to that fraction. This is a number less than one times one over that constant times lambda. So you see that the opening angle is sort of non-perturbative in lambda. This we were talking about this for conformal field theory. In the case of QCD, you can do this not using this method, but you can do it just in a more brute force fashion. Certainly at one loop. So at one loop you can do it, and you get a similar story, except that that here instead of having definite, well, the anomalous dimension will depend on the energy scale, and the energy scale translates into the angle. So if you want to see how things depend on the angle, you will have slightly more the formula is not too complicated, but you have to take that into account. And in the end, you find that this formula is replaced by some other formula where you have alpha of the momentum of the particle divided by alpha times angle squared times the momentum of the particle. All this raised to some power, which is the anomalous, the same C, the same anomalous dimension of those operators I was talking about, divided by the one loop coefficient of the beta function, and so on. But this is a formula to one loop. Here we can easily derive the formula for, well, all loops, just in terms of the anomalous dimension. Okay, so that here I've only talked about this at weak coupling. But one of the points was that these observers are well defined. We can calculate them at all values of the coupling. How do they look at strong coupling? Okay, so.
Is there a lot of QCD data that's sort of plotted in this way? I mean, can you see this cleanly in the?
Yeah, this is. People do not do this, and I haven't figured out why they don't. I think they just haven't thought about it. And they have. The thing is that. I was talking to people who were who did the two-point function. Did this calculation of the two-point function at LEP, computing alpha and so on, and they focused mostly on the large angles. But they didn't study the small angles. And I asked them whether they had a good reason for not studying the small angles, and they said, well, we didn't know the resummation formulas. We just didn't study it. You could study it.
Can they resolve the separate jets well enough to study the small angles?
Well, this is the point, that here you don't have to talk about jets. You don't have to separate anything. All you need to be able to do is be sure that you're measuring the right angles, right? That you. So in practice, you can go up to the small angles the LEP can measure, that which I think are of a few degrees.
So it has to do with the smallest angle size bin that they can measure.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. That's right. So they have bins of certain angles, and then you can just use the energies. The raw data comes with some energies in those bins. You never talk about jets, resolving jets, or whatever. So you directly use this. Primaries. I definitely said that this was a primary. The descendants are just simply moving this thing around, because here we only have the global SL2C symmetry. So we are just, descendants are just simply moving this operator around, so it's not too interesting. I mean, it's already contained in what we are discussing.
In this OPE, why don't you have operators with a transverse spin in the?
Yes, you indeed have them. So I just didn't explain that. But indeed, when you have this, you can have terms which have the form, for example, yj over y to some power, and then some operator that has transfer spin. And indeed, you can do that. And the first operator that appears due to parity considerations and so on are with two. They have a spin 2. And indeed, this is something that thinking about the looking at jets and looking at how the energy is distributed and the spin 2 component and so on is something people have been now trying to use to discriminate between jets created by QCD and jets created by, let's say, highly boosted top quark that is decaying. And so people, they haven't used these particular correlation functions, but they are mostly looking at it from the point of view of probabilities. So what's the probability of it being elliptical or not being elliptical and so on. I think another potential application of this might be to test Monte Carlo calculations, because if you have if you want to implement a Monte Carlo calculation which is computing things, for example, to higher loops, this is a region where you can test whether you are doing the right thing. So you should get the scaling, and if you don't, you are not doing the correct thing. And you can just, in the Monte Carlo, you can put n equal to 4 superior mils and check. So that was this general discussion, and I suspect thinking more about this type of operators might be useful for other purposes and so on. And, I guess Joe has been thinking about, you and Strasser thought about the Pomeron and so on, and I think all that probably can be restated in terms of these operators. I was going to talk about the strong coupling version of this.
Would the Pomeron be naturally have operators not in your span? And this is essentially the way you but other people do. This is the natural way.
And
in some cases, those are the natural operators to have.
Yeah, that's right. I think the general reason is that you have two particles that are moving, right?
At extreme boost relative to each other.
Right. At some very large boost. And so one way we think about interactions of particles is, let's say, a local operator that gets exchanged, right? But this is not useful here. Here you have these non-local operators that somehow get exchanged. And I think that, there's a whole community of people who do soft collinear effective theory, which I think they are studying these operators in slightly different language. They are just, and I think it would be interesting to find the connection between these operators and what soft collinear effective theorists are doing. Strong coupling. So calculating these things at strong coupling is in principle trivial, because we already define them as correlation functions of the stress tensor. So we know how to calculate correlation functions between operators and the stress tensor, and so we should be able to calculate these things with no problem. So we'll have, let's say we have ADS, think of it perhaps in global coordinates if you wish. And we inserted some operator here in the boundary. The operator goes in, and then we have the boundary of the Poincaré region, and we are inserting all these various operators, which insert gravitons, which go in and interact with this state that is falling in, and then we take the expectation value of just this quantity, and just to think about it, imagine that the bra is like taking out the operator here in the future. So in principle, it's a completely straightforward thing to calculate. The only issues is just to choose an appropriate coordinate system where it's easy to think about this problem and to see if there is any simplification that happens when you do this integral. And indeed, there is a simplification that happens when you do that integral. So there will be a coordinate in the bulk, which essentially whose boundary value is y plus. And after you do this integral, you find that the operator is just localized in the y plus equal to 0. So the wave function of the graviton is localized in the y plus equal to 0 plane in the bulk of ADS. And the reason this happens is essentially that the operator has to transform in a simple way under spin, under boost in the y plus y minus directions. It's already extended and has zero momentum in the y minus direction. So in the y plus direction, essentially, the only wave functions you can have are delta functions. And there will be, so as I was saying, will be localized in some bulk coordinate. And then it will have some dependence on the rest of the transverse coordinates. So we had two transverse coordinates, and then we'll have the radial coordinates of ADS. So we'll have some, this wave function will depend on three coordinates. Now, if you look at, you can write ADS in a way that you have this W plus coordinate, then there will be a W minus coordinate, and we'll have no dependence on the wave function will have no dependence in the W minus coordinate. And then some dependence on the rest of the coordinates, and the rest of the coordinates will be an H3 subspace whose boundary is the S2 that we were talking about before. And so the end of the day, what we get is that graviton wave function has the form of a plane wave, so the fact that it has only dW plus squared is clear from the fact that the stress tensor originally had two minus indices, and so that's why it has this plane wave form. And then we can think of in terms of so W mu here, so the Ni is the vector on the two-sphere, so it's a vector in a unit vector in R3, so here we have three indices. In total, we have here four indices, so this W mu square is equal to minus one. And we can think of this as part of the six coordinates of the covering space, so we have W plus W minus plus W mu square equal to minus one. This is the ADS surface. And we just chose some coordinates, and we are looking at the subspace where W plus is 0, so then this other one should be minus 1, and that's the H3 subspace I was talking about. And in terms of these coordinates of this H3 subspace, we have solution of essentially the Laplace equation, which is the form of plane waves.
You're saying that it's a shock wave in the bulk,
yes,
because its intersection with the boundary has to just be this null.
That's right. Yeah, the insertion of a local operator creates a disturbance that goes around the whole bulk. If you do this integral, then you get something that is sharply localized. There's probably one. Okay, so now, so this is the shockwave in the bulk. I more or less told you what it is, but the basic physical picture is that you have the bulk ADS space, and this surface is where this surface corresponds to the ordinary horizon of the Poincaré coordinates. So if you choose Poincaré coordinates, there is some horizon there. That is this surface. Here we've chosen coordinates that are smooth on this horizon. It has the shape of, so we can, maybe I should draw it like this. So everything is uniform in the minus W minus direction, and then here we have this H3, whose boundary is an S2. And then if we are sit at some point theta here, that point theta determines determines a point on the boundary. Let me call it, let me denote them by prime so that we don't get confused. So we this determines a point on the boundary, and that corresponds to a particular shock wave. So there is some shock wave that is extended on this H3 and localized in the transverse directions. Okay, now we need to say a few words about the external state. So we took this external state, creates a closed string that falls in through the surface. So there will be an external state that just falls through the surface. Okay. Now, the important point is that if this external state has well-defined four momentum, then it will cross the surface at essentially at the point. So it will be more and more localized the more this four momentum is well-defined. The closer it resembles a plane wave, it will be more and more localized. And one way to understand why it should be localized is you can write down the momentum generators in these coordinates, and what you find is that they have a form like W mu d dW minus plus W plus dW mu. And so if we see that W plus equal to 0, they simplify because they are all proportional to the same derivative. And we are diagonalizing W minus. This W minus is essentially Q squared. And then different directions in the momentum correspond to different values of W. And W was just simply the coordinate on this H3. W is constrained so that W is this square is minus 1. OK. So we have this particle which on the surface, so let's say this coordinate is what I was calling W plus. So on the surface is localized. It doesn't need to be localized before the surface or after the surface. In fact, it will not be. But it's localized here. And in addition, we have this localized, in addition, the shock wave is also localized on the surface. So we only care, if we want to start calculating this, we only care about what happens on the surface. And we are kind of in a nice situation where everything is localized in the surface, so we can clearly approximate this region by flat space and at least start doing some calculation with this flat space approximation and then move away from that approximation as we go on. Okay, so how does this look in flat space? When in flat space, we just simply have a cylinder that's... in flat space, it's convenient to go to Lycon gauge so that this coordinate I was calling W plus, now it's just one of the flat space coordinates. It's tau on the world sheet. And then at tau equal to 0, we have the shock waves. And the shock waves are just very simple. They we have just simply some H plus plus, which is localized in tau. And there are some transverse positions, and we can choose a plane wave basis for the transverse positions. And so we can definitely take this and insert, so that this will result, the insertion of these external gravitons will result in the insertions of operators on the world sheet at one particular time on the world sheet. And for example, if we were to compute a two-point function, what we would get is simply the integral d sigma 1, d sigma 2, e to the I k 1 dot x. So these are all transverse coordinates, e to the I k 2 dot x. Okay. Now here I'm using a plane wave basis. The actual wave functions of the gravitons will have some shape that is determined by this. But we can Fourier analyze that shape around this region. And so we can use that to translate back and forth between the two pictures. And this, so this correlation function is, well, just the usual things we have in string theory. So sine of sigma 1 minus sigma 2 to some power alpha prime k1 dot k2, etc. And you can do the integral. You get some gamma function. and that gives you that gives you some flat space answers or some gamma function of some arguments which are something like k1 times k2 alpha prime, etc., in the numerator and denominator. I'm going to say more features about this, but you can believe you'll get the usual type of formulas you normally get for such circumstances. And if you are But these wave functions, these external wave functions vary very slowly here in the center. I mean, they have a variation which is of order the radius of ADS. So the momentum that appears here for such external wave functions will be very low. So we can approximate this by, we can expand in powers of the momentum. So this will be 1 plus alpha prime. It turns out that the first correction vanishes and the first non-trivial correction is of this form. And then you can do what I just said of Fourier analyze back and forth here, and what you get in the end is that that energy correlation function goes like 1 plus 1 over lambda, so alpha prime squared is 1 over lambda. Then you get some cosine theta 1/2 squared minus 1/3. So this 1/3 is just to make sure the average gives you the right value. So what we see is that this two-point correlation function is fairly uniform and has this low variation. Let me try to explain a little more the significance of what this means. So remember that at weak coupling we got something slightly different. We got that, for example, when two angles come close together, you have these sharp peaks in the correlation function. The correlation function develops an almost singularity. Well, certainly it has a power law singularity and so on. Here we don't see that. We see very small variation for the two-point function. And this is a signal that this is much more uniform. We can first talk about the case where we neglect all these corrections. And if we neglect these corrections, then that amounts to saying that we neglect all oscillators here in this expansion. And so when you have any number of insertions, you neglect all the oscillators, you just always will get one. And so you just get something that doesn't depend on the angles at all. You have any number of E's will just give you some constant, which is just simply the total energy divided by 4 pi, the volume of the sphere, to n, where n is the number of particles. So you get a completely uniform distribution. That's the leading gravity result. You consider stringy corrections, you start getting some fluctuations. Okay, so so that's the picture of what of how the events look like at strong coupling. So we at weak coupling we start with a situation where we have very narrow, well-defined jets. As we increase the coupling, we start getting more things in between. As we continue to increase the coupling, we start getting such things, and eventually, at extremely strong coupling, we get something completely uniform. And this idea that that this is what you should expect at strong coupling was also pointed out by, I guess, Joe and Matt when they studied deep inelastic scattering. That the basic picture of what is happening here is that you are producing, let's say, the initial gluons, and then they divide into two other gluons, they emit soft radiation, etc., and they very quickly, all the energy split into a huge number of gluons. So that number goes to truly infinity here, and that's what you're getting. Okay, so that's that. Now, let me just mention a couple of one conceptual thing here. What is happening here is that we have this closed string that is falling here, and we are taking a kind of snapshot at this point, and then we let it go and continue, right? And so these energy correlation functions are just the features of that snapshot that we're taking. And you can get differences between different events because you are taking a photograph of some system that has quantum fluctuations. Now, if you have a point-like particle, that if you approximate the string by a point-like particle, which is what you do when you're at strong coupling, of course you can have quantum fluctuations in the position of the particle. But that's just simply the overall momentum of the external operator. So once you fix it, there are no fluctuations for that, for those. So that's why you have no fluctuations. You have always the same answer. Once you have a string that is falling through, the string has some wave function, and it has internal degrees of freedom that can fluctuate. All the various oscillators that are making up the string can fluctuate. And so when you take the snapshot, sometimes you catch the oscillators in one position, sometimes in the other position, and you start getting these fluctuations. So what this correlation function is telling you is that when, if you catch it oscillating, it will be oscillating in such a way, let's say with the, it will be oscillating in such a way that, well, one piece of the string will be closer to here, the other piece of the string will be closer to here. So the energy correlation function will have a peak at, let's say, opposite directions or at the same directions, and so on. And you expect to find the weak coupling answers from a string that has very wide, very big fluctuations. So these oscillators are very highly excited, and the string is very quantum. So you the pieces of the string can get very close to the boundary of the space, and that gives you these big peaks that we have at weak coupling. Okay, so that's just pictures and okay, so before we were talking about this this operator product expansion, and I said this was a very general expansion. And so it's valid at weak coupling, and therefore, since it's very general, it should also be valid at strong coupling. And as a test that we are understanding this operator product expansion, let's discuss it at strong coupling. So how would we see this at strong coupling? Now, from what I said here, it looks like there is no singularity. So we, at first sight, we might think that we don't see it. But remember, when we derived this, we made the approximation that the wave functions of this guy vary very slowly and so on. But if you're doing an operator product expansion, the relative momentum between the two wave functions can get very high. And then you should not use this approximation, but use a different kind of approximation. And the approximation you should use is, it turns out that in these circumstances, so we have this problem of, on H3, we have this the wave functions of the gravitons that come close together, and then you could imagine they could form some particle here that then interacts with the state we are talking about. So the question is, what are the masses of these particles? So this is what ordinarily dominates the operator product expansion in our circumstances. Now, if such a particle was present, appear there, we should be able to see it here in this flat space calculation. So this is the same type of calculation. And it will appear here as poles in this gamma function. This gamma function here in the denominator, and there will be some poles. And of course, poles come from these poles come from the Wellsheet OPE of these operators. So the space-time operator product expansion there corresponds to the Wellsheet operator product expansion. So here we have this circle, and so two of these guys are coming close together. Okay. Now you go and you say, well, what are the masses of those things? So you go and you compute, and you get that the masses of those go like, essentially, the first one goes like 2 over alpha prime. Now, at first, when we got this mass, we thought we did something wrong, because the masses of closed string states are 4 over alpha prime times some integers and so on. There is no state that has mass 2 over alpha prime. Then we thought, well, there might be kind of like an open string, 1 over alpha prime, but that it's neither a closed string nor an open string. Well, the resolution to this is that it is a kind of closed string state, but not an ordinary closed string state. And it is reasonable that it should not be an ordinary closed string state, because if we had obtained a closed string state, an ordinary closed string state, that would be dual to an ordinary operator. And we know that that guy that appears here is not an ordinary operator. It has a spin that no ordinary operator can have, with those quantum numbers can have. So it should not be that. Come here and try to understand a little more in detail what this operator product expansion is. And one can extract the operator that appears. And then one can ask, well, what is that operator and what? And when you do that, you find, well, here at this point I neglected factors of P minus, so the Lightcomb momentum here. But in order to answer this question, you need to put them back. So there are some factors of P minus here. And when you do the OPE, you get the P minus square and so on. These factors of P minus are keeping track of the spin, the same spin we talked about here. And what you find is that this operator, it looks like a fairly reasonable operator in Lightcomb gauge. So it's e to the I k some k dot x, where k squared has this property. So it looks perfectly reasonable. And it's again localized at tau equal to zero. But when you translate, when you ask what operator in covariant gauge would give you this in Lightcomb gauge, what you find is that this is some operator which has the form dA x plus dA x plus to the power 3/2 e to the I kx times delta x plus. Okay. And Joe is smiling because he already found these operators in the previous in the discussion of Pomerons and so on. And what he found was were these operators were here. He found some function of t, so something proportional to alpha prime t, etc.
It's a non-local operator defined by
exactly, yeah. Yeah, it's really not it's not a local operator in the world shed. Definitely not. It is a local operator in Lightcomb gauge. It's a local operator on the world sheet in Lightcomb gauge.
Just like that.
Yeah, but yeah, this also in space time is not.
Gauge is a local operator.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. This is something perhaps I should have mentioned. Is the fact that if you go to Lightcomb gauge, this energy correlation functions become something very simple. So, in Lightcomb gauge, we are just. Remember, in Lightcomb gauge, P minus is like the mass of a non-relativistic. In Lightcomb gauge, the system becomes non-relativistic. And P minus is like the masses of the non-relativistic particles. So this energy operator, all they are doing is like a mass operator. It's measuring how many particles there are with each different values of the masses. So from that point of view, several things that, I've said, for example, the fact that they commute at different points is just the fact that in a non-relativistic system, you can really measure all these masses and that commutes. And these ones are essentially saying you have P minus squared. Instead of P minus, you measure P minus squared. So it's like measuring the square of the energy. And notice that that's precisely what this operator is doing. This operator is essentially the square of the energy. Now, if you naively try to define, you have a system of free particles and you define the square of the energies, this naively defined operator is not infrared finite because you have a splitting, you change this by some factors which would change the value of the operator. But this operator is sort of an infrared finite version of this operator, of this P minus squared. Yeah, and indeed. So you have, but in the same way that these operators are natural in the quantum field theory, this we should enlarge our string theory intuition or set of operators to include such operators. So in the situation with the Pomeron scattering and so on, there was some kinematical reasons why here the exponent was different. In this case, the exponent is just simply given by the spins of the two operators, sum of the spins, and that came ultimately from the dilatation properties of what we are computing in the original. So in the original language, the spin in the y coordinates corresponds to dilatations in the original language. Okay.
And this is local on the world. You said it's not local. It's local on the world sheet.
Well, it's
a local operator with any power and still a local operator.
Well, I think I would call that a non-local operator. So,
does it not commute with, say, ordinary local operators in space-like separation?
Well, how do you you have to bosonize there.
Yeah, then you have to do some non-local definition.
The
OP doesn't have a branch code?
It's a 93.3.
It's kind of not. Well, if you have an X minus somewhere.
You want to say the branch?
You take derivatives, maybe. Yeah.
You're usually discussing software in some environment where the thing in the parentheses has a big VEV and a big expectation value, so you don't know your zero. Right. You don't know the branch cut in some sense.
Right. Well, I really only understand these operators clearly in Lycon gauge. I don't.
It works, of course, it's moved to a state in which you have three halves of an oscillator, etc.
Right.
You're not in box space.
Yeah. All these operators with spin are related to, let's say, taking alpha minus one to some power n. Right. These are the ordinary things.
Yeah.
And this would be like alpha minus one to the 3/2. And so that's. Well, there are more things one can say that I think are interesting from the string theory point of view about these things. And I mean, one question you can ask is, how could it? I mean, here we are computing just the Veneziano amplitude, the four-point amplitude. How can it be that it can have these funny powers and can find these funny poles? I mean, I thought we understood what the Veneziano amplitude was and what where all the poles were. How can it be that we computed in some special kinematical region and we get new poles?
I'm just confused on the last thing you said over here. This operator in the 3/2, dx plus, dx plus, that looks self-adjoint to me. You said it's like alpha to minus 1 to the 3/2?
Yeah.
But isn't alpha minus 1 a creation of a non-self-adjoint operator?
Well, yeah, these are these issues of whether it's local or not. I don't want to get into that. Let's not discuss that. It's a funny operator, so I'm not, even though it's funny, the claim is physically it's important for some things. And okay, so let me address the issue between the Veneziano amplitude and this. So, I guess I'm going over time, and I'm not sure if this digression is interesting for people, but I suddenly found it curious, and it ties into what Matt and Joe were discussing for the Pomeran. So, let me just mention that. Okay, so the question we like to answer now is, how can it be that we start with the Veneziano amplitude and we get this other funny object with poles in different positions? Let's consider the Veneziano amplitude, which has poles in S and T in regular positions. Now, how does this differ from the ordinary amplitude? So the difference is that in the wave functions of this state, so this wave function has a delta of x plus, right? So delta of x plus is just simply the integral dk plus of e to the I k plus x plus, right? So if we forget about this integral, that's the ordinary Veneziano amplitude. So the only difference is in this extra integral. This extra integral translates into an integral over S here, okay? And then what happens is that when you do this integral over S, you need to understand what happens for large S. For large S that this will go like S to some power plus or minus T, I don't remember now. And this is the Ricci behavior of the amplitude. Let's say it's 2 plus T, let's say. I don't remember the precise number here. But the point is, that, let's say for T equal to 0, it's a perfectly convergent answer. But when T is non-zero, so T, I should have also mentioned that T here is K1 dot K2 in that in those formulas. So we're integrating over S at fixed T. And then when T becomes close to, let's say, minus 1, this integral starts going like ds over s, and then it diverges. And that's the origin of those new poles. So the new poles come from the wretched region of the original integral. And okay, so that's that. So that's the answer to that question. Okay, so now there are a few. There are a couple of more things you can do this from the string theory point of view, but let's say we stop here, and let's discuss some things you can say about these correlation functions that are very simple, and they're sort of very elementary, but I think. Kind of a nice story. Now let's study some problem that you would think should be simpler, which is just the one-point function of the energy. So let's imagine we take the vacuum and we insert some current, and we have this one-point function. So this comes from a three-point function of two currents and a stress tensor. And three-point functions in conformal field theories are completely determined. So you would expect it's completely determined. Now, indeed, if this was a scalar operator, it's completely determined. And the answer, for a scalar operator, is just some constant. And so that's fairly simple. Just E. Now notice here, and this is true for everything, and this is just simply the statement of rotational invariance. You have an operator which initially was in a zero angular momentum state, and then decays. It could decay in two particles that go back to back, but they can be going in any direction. So this is just this elementary fact that comes from rotational symmetry. And when you have a current, the current could have some initial spin. So this distribution can have some spin, and there will be a constant piece, and then there could be a piece which is some constant, and the only spin that can appear here is spin 2, and you get this, okay, with some constant here which will depend on the theory you have, okay, and now this. You can ask first, what are the possible values of this constant in a general theory? Something that is clear is that this thing we're computing here should never be negative, because this is supposed to be the energy we measure in some detector, and we never heard of any particle physicist that measures negative energy in their detectors. So now. In principle, that's related to the positivity of this operator, which, if you think about it in Lycon gauge, is clear is positive. In principle, you have to prove that this is always positive. We are close to proving, giving a general proof for any interacting theory, that this is positive. But let me just assume it's positive. So if it is positive, then this A is bounded from above and below by demanding that this quantity never overwhelms this one. And so that gives you a bound on that quantity. So that's a bound on the coefficients that could appear in the three-point function of currents and stress tensors. So currents and stress tensors will have two structures in the three-point functions in conformal field theory. And one of the structures is determined by the fact the current has definite conformal weights and so on. That's equivalent to this one. And then there is the second structure, which is free. It's different in different theories. I mean, these two structures are essentially the two structures you get if you consider a current made out of fermions and a current made out of bosons. So that gives you the two possibilities. And indeed, the bosons and fermions give something where this vanishes at in different ranges of thetas when they are free bosons or free fermions. Okay, so you can ask, how do these things look like, let's say, at strong coupling, for example? So at strong coupling, what are these two different structures we could have? So again, there we can have the current is some photon that is moving in the bulk, and then we have some graviton. And So these different structures correspond to different interaction vertices you can have for a photon and two photons and one graviton. And there are only two possible interaction vertices you can have between two photons and a graviton. And the reason that you can't have many possibilities is because you cannot form any Lorentz invariants from taking this momenta times this moment and so on. So the thing will not depend on any Lorentz invariant. So the thing, you have to make an invariant just purely from the polarization tensors. And there are only two ways of contracting those polarization tensors. And so that's a simple way to see that there are only two structures. And the two structures you can imagine as arising from a term in the bulk which looks like this. The ordinary Maxwell field. And if you take this, what you'll get is this one here. You have another possibility, which is some contraction between the curvature and the Fs. And up to field redefinitions that do not affect the value of the three-point function, there's only one possible coupling. Okay, so you got these two structures, and in principle here there could be some coefficient. This coefficient A is essentially the value of this coefficient in its sort of natural units, so as compared to the previous coefficient. So if you set the radius of ADS to 1 and there is some big coefficient here, and you pull out the big coefficient, you normalize this guy to 1, there is some big coefficient here in front, then this A is essentially whatever appears here.
And you're saying it's bounded.
It's bounded. Yeah, it's ranging.
This is not exactly the same as the kind of things Neeland collaborators got, because it bounds causality, because this is bounded for the level below.
Right, that's right, and they didn't get bouncing gravitational theories. Their bounds were mostly in theories without gravity. Well, were in scalar theories and Yamman's theories. That in that sense is slightly different. But also there is another important difference is that they bounded things around zero. So they forced things to be on one side of zero. The bound here is when this coefficient is very large. So here the bound is an order one bound on this. This translates into an order one bound on this. And when this is of order one, in these units where the radius of ADS is one, this term is as important as this term. And so that's the regime where you can neglect all the higher order corrections. So the bounds here are bound in this in a region where you don't have any reason to trust this approximation. Now, you can have a similar discussion with stress tensors here. And I promise I'm only going to mention one thing about this. So then there are two. There is an A and a B, and a cosine 4 theta, etc. And in this case, again, you get some bounds. And one of the bounds you get agrees with the bound that was obtained from causality in the Gauss-Bonnet theory. So in that case, the one that gives the 1 is square root of gr, and then there is something like a r squared, and then b is some term like r cubed. So these are the structures that would give you these different coefficients, and there are only three. These three different structures are essentially the three different answers you would get if you take a theory of only bosons, only fermions, or only vector fields. So these three theories give you three different combinations. Anyhow, so theories with n equal to 1 supersymmetry, this guy is not there. And these two terms, you can think of it as this is the Einstein gravity plus the Gauss-Bonnet term. And you can solve the questions in this theory, and you find problems with causality if this A is outside some range. And this was one of those problems was discussed in a paper by Meyers, Schenker, Hong Liu, and I'm forgetting probably some authors. I apologize if you're here. It coincides with this one that is obtained from positivity. So in fact, we are again close to proving that the positivity of this and causality are also related, directly related, for any theory. Now this calculation in Gauss-Bonnet gravity is not clear whether we should trust it, because the bound appears in a region where the r squared and r are of the same order. But on the other hand, these bounds on A and B are valid in any field theory. And so one can specialize these bounds in the case of n equal to 1 superconformal field theories. And in that case, they give a relationship between some quantities called A and C. A and C are two quantities which appear in the OPE of two stress tensors, and also when you calculate three-point functions of stress tensors, there are two structures, one given by A and some combination involving A and C. So this one is the structure that gives you some one here, and the other one is the structure that has some angular dependence of this form. And so this positivity bound translates into a bound on A over C of the form 1/2 minus 3/2. Okay, and so this is a bound on these coefficients, which also appear in the conformal anomaly of the field theories, and have been computed for several field theories. And so you get this bound just by thinking about this conformal. About these observables. And I don't know of a way to get this bound which relies on the usual methods that we use to get these bounds, which are, for example, considering the Euclidean theory and demanding positivity and so on. And even if there was such a method, well, this is another simple method to get these bounds. So. And they are saturated for free theories. You can also do this for n equal to 2 theories. It's slightly different and so on. And finally, I'd like to mention one thing which is amusing, and it's the following. So you can consider the general, this thing we did for the energy, we can also do for a charge. So imagine we have the charge, so let's say the electromagnetic charge, and we consider it in a state produced by two currents, right? Okay. Now, in general, if some of these currents are this is related to the three-point function of three currents, and again there are two structures, similar structure to that, but there is a new structure that appears with three currents, which is the one that gives you the anomaly. So there is a parity odd structure that is related to the anomaly of the theory, and that when you translate into what it would give you here, it would give you some charge distribution, which goes like cosine theta, so it has, as opposed to those cosine squares, it has a forward-backward asymmetry. And so this asymmetry is, of course, this name forward-backward reminds you of the things they measure at LEP, for example, where they consider a C, so a state created by a C boson, and you measure the electromagnetic current, or the charge carried by, let's say, different leptons, for example, and you see that the electrons or muons have have some forward-backward asymmetry. So those forward-backward asymmetries are related to the fact that there is an anomaly in the electroweak theory if you consider just purely leptons. So if you consider only the leptons but not the quarks, you have some anomaly, and this directly gives you this forward-backward asymmetry. So in a theory where the quarks were massless and you could sum the charges of the quarks, and also you would get that the forward-backward asymmetry would be zero. What are the conclusions? So one of the messages is that these energy correlations, that energy correlations are natural, infrared finite, and simple observable that one can compute in a conformal field theory, and that one can study them. There is this issue of operator product expansions that lead to these non-local operators, and I think we should probably understand and study more these non-local operators, and they are natural operators that appear in many physical systems. Then we discuss those one-point functions and how they lead to positivity bounds. And we also discussed the picture at strong coupling of what is going on with strings falling through the horizon, and how that can represent the same physics as particles fractionated into lots and lots of gluons and so on. Okay, thank you.
Properties for
these non-local operators, also in any cost factor, is that? Yes. I think in practice the way people compute these dimensions typically is to compute the dimensions for all integer spins, and then find in an analytic continuation in the spin. This is the way I've seen it done mostly. You can directly compute the dimensions from this non-local point of view. So you can write those non-local operators and directly study the renormalization property of those operators and compute the dimensions in that way. So you can definitely do that, and so that allows you to compute directly for non-integer spin. In practice, that method gives you the same as the other method of analytic continuation. So as in terms of calculational technique of what would be the easiest way to do it, I don't know. To think about it. Something that we don't have that would be nice to have is some representation of these operators in terms of states, some funny states in the field theory. In the same way that we have that local operators correspond to states of the theory in the cylinder, is there some representation where these non-local operators with arbitrary spin are states in the field theory and some funny background? So that's a question when it's natural to ask it.
So assume you choose A in that range so we are like on this dot one at a term, but such that it's not a fractional number which would come from having, you know, like what you would see in the gauge theory. Is there a meaning to that? So like because the A and C that you compute, they are integers or fractionality in the case.
Well, A and C could in principle be anything. I mean, in cases where we can compute A and C and they are related to some anomaly, then there will be typically some fractions or some integers.
You could in principle get some kind of irrational, I mean.
Well, this depends on the ratio of A and C. So by going to very large A and very large C, you could get anything in principle. But if you start, so, for example, if you start from, let's say, free field theories, right? That's you start mixing different numbers of bosons and fermions. Well, you'll start generating different numbers here. They'll all be rational. But you're asking the question of what are the properties of A and C? Can they be integer or fractions or continuum? And I don't know.
Okay, so I have some more questions on it.